This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. During the pandemic, we have been returning to check in with some of our favorite State of Things guests from over the years and all of the interviews that we've done. Back in 2018, we met Jesse Hamilton McCoy II. He's the James Scott Farron Lecturing Fellow at Duke Law and supervising attorney for the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic. He's also a housing lawyer who runs Durham's Eviction Diversion Program in partnership with Legal Aid of North Carolina. Since the statewide evictions moratorium ended on June 20th, the courts have been dealing with a spike in claims by landlords. Jesse has been on the front lines of this crisis, and we were curious to know how he's been dealing with the influx professionally and personally. Jesse, welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
How are you? And I mean, how are you really? How are you doing?
We are living in an interesting time, so I am doing as good as could be expected. In light of all of the changes, both in the court system and outside.
I know that you have been going back to court, and there have already been some positive cases at both the Durham and Wake County courthouses. Talk to me about how you have been navigating that and managing the risk for yourself.
Well, I think the first thing that any attorney has to think when they are going back into a court system is you always want to prioritize the safety of your family, because we know that this viruses, COVID-19 travels. And we also know that even before the implementation of any COVID precautions, the courthouse has never been the most sanitary place in the world. It's a place where there's a mass gathering of people. And because of the concern that this virus spreads and many folks are asymptomatic or may not have necessarily been tested, the best that you can do is to try to implement social distancing practices to the best of your ability. Anyone who works in the court system also knows, though, that even for something as simple as just having a case heard through trial, there are already so many different people who have to be involved in that system, to which the degree of risk that you're putting yourself at is still going to be significant. Every hearing has to have a judge, has to have clerks, has to have a sheriff's deputy, has to have the attorney for both sides, has to have the litigants. And then if they're witnesses, they have to have them, too. So anytime that you're coming into interaction with other people, the best you can do is try to make sure that you keep sanitizer on, make sure you wear a mask at all times, and do the best you can. But there's always going to be that degree of risk.
We know we've heard about attempts at both the state level and the federal level to pause evictions to give people some reprieve during the pandemic. We know North Carolina hearings have started again. I wonder if you could just kind of paint a picture for us about who are the people that are facing evictions in this moment, and what has it been like to have this start up again in the midst of a pandemic?
Well, you know, I was a pretty strong advocate for not having a reopened court system for these cases. And there are a couple things to consider here. One is just generally, we had an eviction crisis that was ongoing prior to the onset of COVID. So we were already dealing with a crisis, and COVID has exacerbated all those crises, but it also poses a larger pandemic spread threat. So what we're doing essentially, if we use the court system, in addition to possibly contaminating people who are coming into the court system, we are also then saying, okay, well, these people have to be removed from their homes, many of whom have had their employment affected because their hours have been reduced if their jobs have not been eliminated altogether. So they have not been able to pay their rent. And we're having them removed and bear the brunt of a system that isn't necessarily fairly designed for them. But what happens after the court case? So after the court case, they're going to be removed from their property. They have to find an alternate place to live. So assuming that somebody did get infected at some point along the way, you run the risk of them spreading it as they try to navigate to a new living situation.
Hmm. So we spent the whole hour with you back in 2018, and you shared a lot about your life story and the responsibility that you really feel to your family and community, since so many of them were not able to escape the cycle of poverty as you have. I wonder, in this moment when you are navigating doing this work and recognizing the increasing gap, wealth gap and economic gap furthered by the pandemic, how are you navigating kind of your past and your experience with the experience of those that you are serving in the court?
Well, I think the one thing is I want anybody that I represent to know that they have someone who is knowledgeable about the system, but also knowledgeable and respects them as a person. I think so often with the astronomical numbers of evictions that we see, it becomes systematic to a point that people are devalued and become numbers in a chain of evictions. So I want my clients to at least know that we're going to advocate for their best interest and we're going to listen to them. What really gives me my inspiration, though, is I hear harrowing stories from the clients that I serve about the things that they've had to do or the things that they've had to forego in order to try to make something work. And what we have to realize is in any system that is predicated on housing being a commodity, then whenever you have an economic downturn, there's always going to be fallout for people who are the low-income wage earners. There's always going to be fallout. And there's not a lot of relief systems for that. So my job sometimes can be a very sad place because there's not always a defense to an inability to pay rent. However, in North Carolina, we do have some added protections that we didn't have before, specifically as they relate to COVID. And so what we've been trying to do is, one, educate the landlords and their representatives about new policies in place because of things like the CARES Act or things like the governor's executive order, which is requiring that there be conversation about a repayment period to extend it for 6 months. But we also have to be real about the fact that not every property is going to be a recipient of any sort of federal funds for which the CARES Act would protect them from. And in those situations, oftentimes those are going to yield intensely difficult conversations for me to my clients about not just why they have to leave, but about how the system in and of itself is unfair and unjust.
So what options do these tenants have who have lost their jobs, who aren't able to pay, who aren't getting any reprieve from the landlords that own their properties? When you have those conversations, what do you say? I mean, what options do they have?
Well, the options are very limited, but I always like to take a step back. So first, you know, no eviction is similar to another. There are some people who just simply don't know that the property they live in is one of the properties that receives federal funding or has a federally backed mortgage. And if that's the case, they do qualify for protections under the CARES Act. So I always try to make sure that we do the deep dive to find out what it is that that particular person is dealing with. But if we're looking at the situations where there is no relief, there is no rental assistance that can cover the number of months that they've been out of work, unfortunately, we don't have a good mechanism of dealing with that. We are still in the process of waiting for the United States Senate to approve CARES Act funding to help working people who are in these situations where they have developed this huge accumulation of rental debt. Because they have not been working. And I think last conversation when they were talking to the Senate, this bill is like a $100 trillion bill. So that money is still on somebody's table in Washington, D.C., waiting for a vote. Meanwhile, people are still stressed out and dealing with the consequences of not having, many of which were consequences that they did not cause for themselves.
So at the end of the day, after you've had that conversation with someone and you've gone through all of that and it still turns out that they're going to a tenant is really going to likely lose their home, how does that change your job and how do you cope with that kind of at the end of your workday? That seems so hard.
It is intensely difficult. The main thing is for anybody who's represented by me or anybody who's part of my staff, I always want to make sure that my contact information is available. And they can talk to me. Sometimes people call me and they just want to vent about what's been happening. And I totally understand and appreciate that. Unfortunately, the other part of my job is it's voluminous. So when I finish with one situation, I have an entirely different set of situations that are coming in that also require my attention. And so part of this is talking to our government leaders about what needs to be done in order to fix things. But the other side of it is just helping people to cope in a situation that is inherently unfair. And my hope is that my voice in going in both directions will be such that we can influence movements that we are seeing people take on now. So one of the big things you're seeing nationally is this concept of a rent strike. I can't necessarily as an attorney advocate one way or another as far as rent strikes go. But the fact that people are working up the energy to collectively realize their value in this system that seems to be inherently unfair to them is powerful. And we're not just seeing that with the housing market. We're seeing that in a number of movements in society.
Well, that brings me to a question about kind of working within the system. I mean, you have an obligation as a lawyer to represent these clients and work within the legal system as it is, yet you have a perspective about the inequities that exist. And you mentioned earlier kind of housing as a commodity versus housing as a human right. So for you, I mean, do you believe that the system can be tweaked from within in the way that it is right now to get to a place where there is more fair housing law and there is more access? Or do you believe there needs to be some kind of, you know, starting over, if that's even possible?
This is going to sound like a real lawyer answer. both. So my position is, I think that we as a society need to declare housing to be a right. I think we all realize that it should be a right, but we haven't had the will or the resolve to make it so legally. And because of that, we've treated housing for centuries as a commodity for which only the people who have the legitimate income access are able to have it, when we know everybody needs it. That is only exacerbated by COVID-19. People not having housing poses a threat to all of our health. So that's a public health crisis embedded in what was already an eviction crisis. On top of that, I think that part of establishing housing as a right is understanding that there needs to be a developer who is going to be either supported with federal funding or what have you to develop places that will be for the demographic of the local income levels that you see for that community. Oftentimes we get caught up in this term affordable housing, and oftentimes the implication of that is a federal standard, which is vastly different from what the income level is for people living in a given community. So I think we need to localize some of those policies and develop a supply or a stock of housing that will give people the access to the housing that they can actually afford and help them in their quest to get back on the right side of things.
When you are working with people who are dealing with evictions, I mean, how much contact do you have with landlords? And I guess what insight do you have about their role in the system? I mean, when we say landlords, we're talking about, you know, anything from a national housing corporation to someone who's just renting out the top floor of their house. They're both considered landlords, but I imagine that they approach renting differently. How do you deal with landlords from various capacities, and how does that impact the eviction process?
Well, one of the things that's important to note is that landlords are not monolithic. So there are some landlords who everything is about the money. They could care less about the people. And for those folks, we try our best to connect folks with rental assistance funds. But if we cannot, or if they do not qualify, we still want to drum up that we are dealing with the human industry and not just a financial banking product, right? For other landlords, though, the problem is that they have overhead too. And it's certainly not fair for them to have to consistently eat the cost when their tenants are unable to pay. But they also appreciate that it's not the tenant's fault that they can't pay. So this is where government really has a responsibility of stepping in to supplement the wages that tenants no longer are able to collect and to offset the expenses that the landlords are experiencing, because if we can eliminate the cost to the landlord, then they wouldn't have an incentive to go try to evict people. But again, we need government to take stronger, more decisive action than what they have done.
When you spoke with us back in 2018, one of the things that you said that just stood out with me so much is you were talking about an experience as a young kid being pulled over and dealing with law enforcement in ways that were unfair and discriminatory. And it kind of turned you into this convicted person who wanted to go into law. And you said, I want to be in a position when I grow up where I can stand against bad law enforcement officers and expose what they're doing and equalize the playing field. I'm wondering how you reflect back on that younger self now in this moment. I mean, do you feel like you have fulfilled that wish of your younger self?
Well, I did. When I initially came into the practice of law, I started off doing primarily criminal defense, and we were able to expose a lot of bad officers who were preying on low-income, poor Black and brown communities. And so what I realized in doing that work, though, is that the criminal justice reform is only one piece of a larger system of racial inequity. So in trying to advocate for more so equity for all people, what I've been trying to do is kind of analyze each area in which people are set back, housing being one of the major ones. And because people have not historically been able to get equal access to mortgages, equal access to housing, any of those things, and because these have been systems that have been perpetuated by federal legislation, it is important for us to emphasize that our leaders have a responsibility to equalize that playing field. Now, whether they decide to do that or not is certainly going to rest with what their personal decision and their constituency reflects. But I think it's more important to understand also that we are living in a time in Durham where there are people who are paying higher levels of rent than what some people are paying in mortgages. And because of that, it's just a matter of trying to educate the populace on how home ownership looks. What do you need to do in order to secure a mortgage? And on top of that, we're also dealing with a big gentrification issue in Durham. So we have people who have had property that was passed down to them that they've owned since the early 1900s, but now out-of-state corporations are coming in offering top dollar to get the property because the out-of-state corporations see the vision of what Durham is going to be in 5 years or 10 years, and the people who live here may not necessarily know or appreciate that and are giving up their value for that check. So I think that there are a lot of things that we, once I dove into the practice of law and started realizing the inequalities that abound, there are a lot of different ways that you can go with it. But the main priority is that we always are going to need an advocate to stand up for the little person to fight against the big moneyed interests that will always be able to dominate with their power and control.
Jesse Hamilton McCoy II is a housing lawyer. Thank you so much, Jesse.
Thank you.
You can find out more about him and everything else we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. I'm Anita Rao.